I'm Mike Webb, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. Last week, reporter Abram Lustgarten launched a new investigation about injection wells and how U.S. industries, ranging from agriculture to pharmaceuticals to, of course, gas drilling, have used these disposal units to get rid of more than 30 trillion gallons of waste over the past several decades. Officials had long assumed that the deep layers of rock beneath the earth would keep these chemicals buried safely in the ground, but the science is far less conclusive than it's portrayed to be. And while we wait for solid evidence that injection wells work, several accidents around burial sites are signs that problems may be more prevalent than thought. Mr. Lustgarten, the energy industry's favorite reporter, joins us by phone from California to explain why injection wells may quickly become the nation's next big water pollution problem. Welcome, Abram.
Hi there, Mike.
All right. Since you've written so many stories about the dangers of hydraulic fracturing, people have already confused this new report with fracking. So explain how this is different.
Well, this isn't just about gas drilling. It's not even just about energy production. This is just what the country does with liquid waste. The vast majority of liquid waste goes into these underground wells. When fertilizer is manufactured, all the chemical byproducts go into these wells. When uranium is mined, all the radioactive wastewater goes into these wells, along with everything else. So it's really, it's more about dumping. It's more about what happens underground that we can't see than it is about a controversy over over fracking or this process of cracking open the rock in the eastern seaboard.
And is this how they get rid of all industrial fluid waste?
Fluid waste, yes. It is by far the predominant method. And even for some non-fluid waste, the powders or solids are dissolved into fluid so that they can be injected. So it's really the most relied on form of waste disposal in the United States.
And did people really believe that you could just pump these dangerous chemicals into the ground and that they'd stay there forever?
They do. There's two philosophies. One is that oil and gas comes out of reservoirs that are deep underground, and if the reservoirs could have held the oil and gas down there for 10,000 years, then why can't the rock, you know, hold whatever other waste we put down there? And the second, and this may be a familiar argument, but the second thinking is that multiple layers of rock will keep anything from floating or making its way back up towards the surface. And the water that's at risk when we talk about aquifers or drinking water usually is within a couple hundred or even a couple thousand feet of the surface, but not so far down as the injection wells, which can be 6,000 or 8,000 feet. So the question is, what barriers are between the injection zone and the aquifers to allow waste to come up?
And there really has been no previous studies about what happens?
Well, this is what is so fascinating to me in doing this reporting. I mean, there's a real near unanimous conventional wisdom that this process is safe, but I could not, in months and months of reporting on this, find anybody who could base that conclusion on solid data. And that's because the Earth is obviously very remote and very far out of reach, and there are no wells to monitor what happens with contaminants. There is no hands-on testing. And so all of the scientists that I spoke with and all of the companies that use this practice, and even the federal government, they rely on computer models to tell them what should happen down underground. Now, sure, these are some of the most advanced models in the world, and they have very sophisticated inputs, but they really amount to a hypothesis, and it can be a very strong hypothesis, but it's absolutely not a certainty.
And does this affect just a few states, or is this a national problem?
Well, there's a number of different kinds of wells. Every state has a type of injection well. Class 5 wells are the most prevalent, and that's the stuff that we dump at our gas stations or in our neighborhoods. And those are the most difficult to regulate and also probably not the most dangerous. The ones that we really are focusing on are deep injection wells, where oil and gas waste or industrial chemical waste is injected thousands of feet underground. That happens in about 30 states, mainly the Gulf Coast states, Louisiana, Texas, and so forth, and then up around the Great Lakes and the Appalachian states, where the geology is supposed to be supportive of the process.
What's the difference between a Class 1 well and a Class 5, just to go to the extremes?
Yeah, sure. A class one well is constructed very much like an oil or gas well. It's a vertical pipe that goes deep, deep underground. It's got all sorts of layering and special mechanisms to monitor for problems. And you take hazardous, often, or sometimes non-hazardous liquid waste and dump it down through this well. And when it reaches its bottom hole, or the ultimate depth, then that waste just dissipates into a porous rock formation. A class 5 well is almost the opposite. It's very shallow and it's very casual. It's defined by the Environmental Protection Agency as any hole that's deeper than it is wide. So if you go and drill or dig a 10-foot hole in your backyard and dump a bunch of stuff in it, that's a class 5 well. More formally, septic systems or drainage systems at a gas station might take waste down, 70 or 80 feet and let it dissipate into the mud. That's a class 5 well.
Okay, and 2, 3, and 4 are some level in between.
Exactly.
Okay. Who had authority or oversight of this process? Is it the EPA or is it state by state?
It's both. It's ultimately all authority rests with the Environmental Protection Agency. According to federal law, under the Safe Drinking Water Act, the EPA was given responsibility for making sure that anything put in the ground is protective of drinking water. They delegated that authority to state agencies. If a state agency proves through a pretty long application process that it can protect groundwater, that it has regulations in place that meet the EPA's base level, then they can have what they call primacy or primary regulatory authority. So the result is that, in two-thirds of the states regulate the injection process with the EPA kind of looking on. In the remaining states, the EPA does still have direct authority and makes all of the decisions about what can and can't be injected and how it's done.
Abram, is it clear why the EPA hasn't taken a more aggressive stance in regulating this?
Well, I think it's just a matter of limited funding and limited staffing. The EPA's budget for this program has more or less stayed the same or decreased slightly over the last 30 years, leaving out, of course, inflation and the increasing size of the problem. EPA could not even respond to some of my questions about simple measures like how many inspectors it had in the field to check the places where the EPA has sole authority. In general, it wasn't able to answer a lot of my questions and didn't have a real grasp on the scope of its own program. It hadn't, for example, tallied up the number of well failures or pollution instances over the last 20 years. It couldn't tell me how many well failures there had been. We got their data and figured that out ourselves. So you see a bit of what appears from the outside to be a lack of coordination on the EPA's part, and I think that that's probably part of what makes it difficult for them to wrangle this 50-state very broad program and control all of these state agencies who also are involved. They need more people, more of a directive, and more money to do that.
Were there other obstacles that you had to overcome to pull this all together?
Well, the EPA wasn't particularly cooperative. They forced us to go through Freedom of Information requests for any information that we did get. Some of those requests remain unanswered after 2.5 years. They didn't give any interviews at any of the regional offices, and they answered some questions selectively by email. So that was a huge barrier, especially given the complexity of this as a scientific topic. Some of the states were the same. Texas declined to grant any interviews for this story, despite the fact that much of my reporting focused on Texas. They were cooperative in answering email questions, but really limited it to email. Other states, like Ohio, did offer interviews, but again, forced us to rely on the Freedom of Information process to get documentation. Nobody was really forthcoming about how this program runs and how successful it is or is not.
Is that partly because there's not a lot of science about it and they don't know and don't want to say they don't know? And are other scientific studies being performed to understand, what will eventually happen?
Well, there's very little scientific research into the fate of fluids that are injected underneath. The Department of Energy now in Pennsylvania is conducting a study to examine this question. It's one of very, very few that I know about. They're going to look at weather chemicals can migrate through underground fractures and faults in the rock and how far they'll move underground. I think it's a little different from the issue of, you know, of state and the federal government's reticence to be cooperative. It's an obscure topic. I don't think it's been a high priority in many of these agencies for a long time. I think when someone comes asking questions, it quickly puts them on the defensive.
Okay. Now, you have three related sidebar stories that I hope people will read. Can you break down one of those for us and just sort of tell us what happened?
Sure. You know, we looked at a site called the Aristech Chemical Corporation. It's in Haverhill, Ohio, just on the southern border by Kentucky. This is a Class 1 hazardous waste well, and it goes back decades. The wells, there's three wells on the site, and the first ones were drilled in the late 1960s when practices weren't as stringent as they are now and the regulations weren't as strong. But in 1989, they went to drill a third new well, and the regulations that are modern, considered modern today, were in place in 1989, and so the protections were stringent. And in 1989, they were drilling this well partway down on the site where there's these other two wells, and they ran into partway down what amounted to a whole bunch of contamination that shouldn't have been there. And what happened, what scientists concluded over years and years of studying this site, is that the chemicals, some really bad, deadly kind of chemical mixtures that were injected into the first two wells very deep, had been migrating up from those wells, and the third well had intersected it on its way. And it launched this whole investigation, and really was a focal point for the regulatory program across the country to figure out what happened in Ohio and to figure out if these chemicals were going to continue making their way up into water supplies. State and federal agencies looked at this for about 15 years. In 2005, they closed the case. They determined at that point that they thought the risk was pretty low, though it was a very interesting example of how rock layers do not always contain the chemicals that are put underneath them. But they did close the case, and they've now walked away from the site, and it's not really clear what is happening there or whether those chemicals will continue to move over the future years.
You show how injection wells that follow the EPA's most stringent rules have failed in the past. So what's the solution? Because there are already 680,000 some wells. So what can be done about this?
Well, the experts that I talk with all more or less agree that the most stringent version of the regulations for Class 1 hazardous waste wells, which is kind of the most serious category, are pretty good. And those regulations are really only applied to a very small subset of the universe of injection wells out there. So one obvious first step, if you want to make this overall practice safer without changing the nation's waste-producing practices, is to just regulate all wells the way you regulate Class 1 hazardous waste wells. And that means that, for example, monitoring wells might be drilled around the site to know whether contaminants are leaking into water or are on the move. It means that pressure readings inside the well, which would detect a crack or some kind of leak, are happening not just periodically or daily or weekly, but actually in real time. On some of these wells, there's equipment at the wellhead that just signals an alarm if there's a pressure exceedance. When you look at some of the Class 2 wells out in Texas, they're tested every 5 years. In theory, that well could be leaking for 4 years, 364 days before you discover that leak. So these are the kind of strengthening of the current regulations that could make a real difference. Other experts I talked to point to recycling of liquid waste. It's something that's happening a lot in the oil and gas industry in Texas right now.
Really?
Reducing the volume of water so it can be reused. Some of the contaminants are taken out. The contaminants over time might get more and more concentrated, but their volume becomes less and less. So you might still be injecting waste underground that's really dangerous or really nasty, but because there's less of it, you're going to mitigate the risk to some extent. In addition to that, just a further and extensive studying of what sites are suitable for this kind of injection and what aren't. You know, geologists and geoscientists that I speak with talk about regions where they do have some degree of certainty that the rock is impermeable. But injection wells happen in lots of places where they don't have that certainty at all. And one of the examples I looked at in my story was in Florida, a number of wells, over 100 wells, were permitted with the assumption that the rock would contain it, and it very quickly did not. 20 of those wells have failed, and sewage injected there has migrated up into drinking water, and what they basically found is that the rock was so porous that they never should have injected there in the first place. It wasn't so much an accident as it was bad planning, and if you could kind of plan ahead for that in the future and choose your sites more carefully, that too could lessen the risks.
And to backtrack a little bit, how did you get started on this story, and did it get interrupted by your other reporting work?
Oh, well, oil and gas reporting has made me a bit of a geology nerd. you know, the premise of the natural gas drilling debate is this question of whether fracking should be regulated. And I got really curious about, if it were regulated, what would it be regulated as, and what's that program? And it turns out that the answer is the EPA's Underground Injection Control Program under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And so that was the genesis of some curiosity, and I started just asking some questions around that and found a whole lot of people who had concerns not just about oil and gas drilling and having nothing to do with fracking, but what happens with all this waste that is injected underground. I quickly realized that the fracking debate's about a relatively small volume of contamination compared to this huge universe of material that's injected underground through this regulated program.
All right. Well, Abram, this is some fantastic work. Really appreciate you joining us to talk about it. For more on ProPublica's new injection well series, visit ProPublica.org/injection wells to see all of our reporting on this issue. And now for our official Say the Darndest Things Tumblr quote of the week. That's a clown question, bro. Who said it? Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, borrowing a phrase from Washington Nationals rising star Bryce Harper during a news conference. Okay, that's it for this week. If you have any questions, comments, or criticisms about the show, please email us at communications@propublica.org. And as always, thanks to Minheet Cho for producing and to you for listening. For ProPublica, I'm Mike Webb. We'll catch you next time.